Welcome to Ixnay, the podcast where we take a deep dive into the shallow end of the electorate as a means to gaming the 2020 election to our advantage. Turn on, tune in, vote out.
Hey, all right, now. Our mantra for the week, don't just stand there, do something. I'm Trace Crutchfield, and this is Ixnay. As we were about to hit publish on this episode, word broke that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had passed, and we couldn't figure out if everything suddenly changed or if nothing has. On one hand, it remains as important as it ever was to bounce Donald Trump out of office along with everyone who's empowered him. But what has changed, aside from the terrifying prospect of Trump getting to pick Justice Ginsburg's replacement, is that we have been jolted awake with an adrenaline shot to the heart. Right when we most need to remember that each and every one of us has a role in ending this national nightmare. It's already clear that Trump and the Republican Senate will never grant RBG's dying wish. So like Sean Connery in The Untouchables, we ask, what are you prepared to do? In a moment of weakness, Donald Trump recently revealed to Bob Woodward the anxiety he feels brought on by what he recognizes as, quote, dynamite behind every door. He's right to be worried because we are the dynamite. I mean, is there anything that Donald Trump fears more than people? We, the great unwashed, are the dynamite. We have an opportunity to design the future, and it starts by putting distractions aside and putting some real work into denying Donald Trump a second and even more disastrous second term. Does that mean voting for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris? Yes. And if you're having a hard time with that, you'll definitely want to listen to our interview with one of the most notorious political activists in history, Bill Ayers. He's been known to use Occam's razor in a street fight, so it's no surprise he cuts straight to the heart of what's at stake and what you can do about it. Speaking of which, daylight is burning. It's now or never, people, so if there was ever a time to become a member of Ixnay Pack, to choose the red pill over the blue pill, it's now. Go to ixnaypack.org, claim your membership card, and donate what you can. Unlike most podcasts and all political action committees, we've shied away from the endless begging and advertising, and never have we asked for support up front here on the podcast. But time is of the essence. Election day is just around the corner, and as unimaginable as it seems, a lot of people have yet to make up their minds. In short, it's crunch time. So if you've had enough of the Trump presidency and can help us help you in any way, do it now. Because we are accelerating. I like to think of it as escape velocity, jetting towards the finish with our newly launched phone banking operation, a team of folks handwriting letters to undecided voters, and of course, our original guerrilla postering and stickering hijinks. All we need now is your help. And now, a word from Ixnay co-conspirator Tim Kinsella on how struggle, with no promise of celebration, can be its own reward.
Hello, I'm Tim Kinsella, from a bunch of bands you've never heard of unless you're a super weirdo, and author of a few novels no one bought. I understand the cynicism many people feel about the two-party system and electoral politics, but this is different. Our monster president has made it abundantly clear publicly that he's already interfering with the integrity of the election and that he won't accept the results unless he wins. This is the greatest threat to our system of government that our country has ever faced. And the only peaceful chance we have of overcoming this threat is to show up in historic and overwhelming numbers to demand new leadership. The existential problems of racial injustice, income inequality, and climate change that we face as a country and a civilization will not be instantly solved with new leadership in the White House, but new leadership is imperative to even have a fighting chance. We can overcome these huge systemic problems and create a better world of opportunities for all of us, but not without first restoring simple values in our leaders, values like trust, truth, compassion, and commitment. We all want our favorite independent bars and clubs and restaurants and local businesses to come back, right? I carried a Xanax in my pocket for years, but I never needed it, just because I knew it was there. Donald Trump and his army of demons now has me needing it. But the greatest anti-anxiety remedy I've found is getting involved. We're making calls to targeted, undecided voters in swing states and writing postcards and letters, and it feels very good. Like together we can all make a difference. There are plenty of good organizations fighting for righteous causes. Commit to one that feels right to you and do it for a little while each day. And if you don't feel like Googling your options, just go to ixnaypac.org and we'll be happy to put you to work. Thank you.
If you want to join our letter writing and or phone banking initiative, email us at info@ixnaypac.org. Or if you want to practice your phone delivery while inquiring, leave us a message on the hotline. That's 512-766-8279. And now, to the highlight of this week's episode, ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome to Mr. Bill Ayers.
Thanks for the time, Bill.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start by just throwing out seven words or concepts that I think you're particularly well situated to define for us. I mean, they're ideas that I think have been distorted and factionalized almost to the point of demonization. Does that sound like an okay way to launch into things?
I would love it. I'll probably fall flat, but let's try it.
Nah, I think you can handle this. These are all right in your wheelhouse, I think. Okay, so here we go. These are Ixnay's seven not-so-dirty words. And the number one on the Ixnay not-so-dirty word list is freedom.
Freedom. Should I riff a minute on freedom?
Yeah,
what I think,
lay it
what
on
comes
me.
To mind? Well, you know, I think in America, we should understand that a word like freedom is both dense, layered, and contested. It doesn't have a single meaning. It doesn't have a dictionary definition. It's brought to life through various publics who bring it to life. So the reason I say it that way is because we tend to, as a default, go to freedom as individual personal choices. So I get to choose whether I'm going to watch ABC or NBC or Netflix, right? And that's freedom. That's the way we kind of consider it as a default. The problem with that is that it leaves aside the question of political freedom or social freedom or collective freedom. So the freedom movement was not a movement for my individual ability to do X, Y, or Z, although that was encompassed in it. So my ability to sit on a bus, eat at a lunch counter, have access to a drinking fountain, that was part of it. But that was in many ways a side trip to the fact that it was a movement about the freedom of an entire people who were facing obstacles, challenges, oppression based on their membership in that group. So gay liberation, gay freedom, women's freedom, black freedom, or you think of the anti-colonial struggles in the 1950s and 60s around the world. These were all under the banner of freedom, Uhuru, freedom now. And what did that mean? That meant freedom for the collective, for the social group. That's one way to think about it and to wonder about it. The second thing I would say is that I said it's a contested word. You have to remember, as a kind of classic case in American history, that the Civil War was fought about freedom, and everyone was fighting about freedom. On one hand, the abolitionists, the self-liberating enslaved workers, they were fighting for their freedom, the freedom to do away with slavery. On the other side, the Confederates, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, they were fighting for a single freedom, the freedom to own other human beings. And it was very clearly stated in exactly those terms. So when the Civil War ended, you know, the struggle about reparations, which goes on to this day, was a struggle about who got harmed. And the so-called lost cause of the Confederacy won that argument. The people who got reparations were the people who lost their property. There's a phenomenal book that's just been published called, I'm going to think of its name. It's called, I've suddenly forgotten the name. It's by Zora Neale Hurston. Oh, it's called Barracoon. And it's a story of Cujo, the last black cargo. And Cujo, in this really phenomenal book, he speaks in his own dialect and she transcribes the dialect. It takes a minute to be able to read it. But once you get to it, it's a brilliant, brilliant book. But what, in light of this question of freedom, what's interesting is that Cujo was an enslaved person for about 5 years when the Civil War was won and emancipation proclaimed. So he and his fellow workers went to their former owner and said, we think we deserve, it's a matter of justice, we deserve to be paid for the fact that we labored all those years and right. we were never paid. We want to be paid. And the owner says to them very indignantly, you didn't lose any property. I lost property. I lost you. Therefore, I should be paid. And that struggle, that argument, that discussion is still going on. So what is freedom? In my view, we have to make it complicated. We have to think hard about it. We can't rely on it as a slogan. We have to imagine what... I have one more example that just popped in my mind.
Sure.
I don't know if you saw Boots Riley's film a couple of years ago called Sorry to Bother You.
Yes.
I think it's one of the most brilliant films I think I've ever seen. But Boots Riley gets into the question of freedom. And as the film goes along, you see advertisements on buses and on street corners for a corporation called Worry Free. And there's a group of, the picture is always a family, a white family, kind of Leave It to Beaver kind of family, kind of an American stereotype. And it says, worry free. We will guarantee, your rent will be paid, you will have food and so on. And as it evolves, as you get closer into it, you have to sign a labor contract. And it basically you sign away yourself to be a slave. And then they'll take care of food, housing, healthcare, and it's all taken care of. It's worry-free and it's freedom, right? Except that it's also slavery. And so I think when we get into the question of freedom, I apologize for word one of your 7-word list but I'll be briefer. But I think that's a really complicated word, and I don't think we should settle for a Webster's dictionary definition.
Well, I think that's what makes it interesting, right? That it is something that people, you know, they project their own meaning onto it, but it is a complicated word, and you know, that's why it's made my list.
I mean, of course, and actually when you say people, so I had mentioned the slave owners fighting for the freedom to own people, but we could say the same thing today about carbon extractors or about, you know, child labor enforcers and so on. They also want the freedom. Why are you coddling the little kids? They could be making, you know, gym shoes for me. I mean, that's freedom, right? And that's freedom in the American context. So we have to be careful when we throw that word around.
That is complicated now. Okay, let's move on. Number 2 on the Ixnay not so dirty word list is radical.
It's another word that gets in the American lexicon gets used a lot. So I remember growing up and every advertisement was for a radical house cleaning product or a radical toothpaste or a radical new recipe for, you know, chicken soup. I mean, radical gets used to mean extreme or innovative or something like that. But the real meaning of radical is going to the root. And that's the root meaning of the word. And that's what I think most people who are radicals think of it as. So in other words, and famously, Ella Baker, the great, great leader of the Black Freedom Movement in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s. Ella Baker always said, I use radical in its true meaning, meaning going to the root. So it's not just that I want the right to ride on a bus or to go to a drinking fountain. I'm going to the root. I want to get to the root of the problem. And that is justice. That is the myth of Black inferiority. That's the enforcement of white supremacy. A radical wants to go to the root and deal with that, not simply the surface manifestations of that. The same is true during the Vietnam War, which is when I became a radical. I was opposed to the war. I worked hard to end the war. I became an organizer and an activist against the war. But it took me a minute, not too long, but it took me a minute to understand that what I really wanted was to end the cause of war. And I wanted to end the Vietnam War very badly. But I also thought, why are we going to end the Vietnam War and go to war in Santo Domingo? Why are we going to end that war and go to war in Africa? Let's get at the root. And the root is, you know, imperialism, predatory capitalism, racial capitalism. And the more I understood that, the more I wanted to be a radical against war, not simply a liberal.
That's perfect. All right. Number 3 on the Ixnay not so dirty word list is activism.
Man, you got some great words. So, you know, I think that I think of myself as an activist, and an activist is somebody who sees something that they perceive to be a wrong and is willing to get off the couch and do something about it. I think I would make one distinction, because these words are often used interchangeably. I think most organizers are activists, but not all activists are organizers. And I want to be both. That is, an organizer is somebody who sees as their responsibility the reaching out and being in communication, in dialogue with a large body of people, with a mass of people. Organizers organize. And I got lucky and grew up in the, came of age in the mid-1960s and became an organizer in a community organization in Cleveland as part of the Black Freedom Movement. I then became an anti-war organizer. But in both situations, I was also an activist, willing to, you know, find ways to effectively put my body on the gears in a way that tried to stop the death machine or stop the racist nightmare. And those are, I wouldn't use those words interchangeably. I'd say all organizers are activists, but not all activists are organizers. And I think it's important that we be both.
Very good. Very good. Number four on the ICSA not so dirty word list is liberation.
Liberation?
Yes.
Very much like freedom. I think of those two words as interchangeable in a certain way, liberation and freedom. I think freedom is, liberation is, for me, is more of an active verb. And right. And I think we should think of it as a verb. Freedom is kind of often misdefined as a noun. But I think liberation is a collective act of a people defining, coming into view as a people. In other words, creating a public and then asking to overcome the challenge that stands in their way. A simple example from my lifetime, and I think most people can remember this, is that gay liberation, queer liberation, there was no such thing as the gay community until it was brought into being by gay people standing up and speaking out and saying, this is who we are gay. And then people from very many different classes, backgrounds, races, ethnicities, geographical regions could define themselves as part of that public. They were probably part of many other publics. In fact, we're all part of many, many identities and publics. But when gay people defined themselves as gay and said, this is an obstacle to our collective freedom, then that meant people who were, you know, corporate vice presidents and people who were street people and people who were Black and people who were Latinx and people who were working class and people who were poor or low wealth people could all say, but I'm part of that too. I'm gay. And therefore standing up against the obstacles to my full expression of my freedom, that's liberation. So I think the funny, there's a paradox here too, which is liberation happens precisely at the moment when you see yourself as oppressed. In other words, if you don't see your oppression, if you can't name it, then you can't be it. And the weird, and this is something I learned painfully when I was underground for 11 years, which is there's a way in which you never feel freer than when you're naming the obstacle to your freedom. You never feel more liberated than when you say, this is what's stopping me from being fully human, or this is what's stopping my next door neighbor from being fully free or fully human. And so, for example, so when you say gay people can't be married, gay people are arrested for the very normal activity of being a sexually defined person, we're being arrested for that. And we can't get married and we can't hold certain jobs and we can't speak our truths. And when we say that, we feel liberated in a way that we don't when a bill passes. And that there's a paradox there, right? Because you're fighting to get that bill passed or to get that court decision. But it's actually the naming of the obstacle when the feeling of liberation rises up so powerfully.
Yeah, I think in that context of gay liberation too, the act of coming out, right? This is the first step to every individual's defining their own liberation. Yeah, that's a fascinating point.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that it's the saying, it's the defining yourself by something that's been kind of put on you as a, as an oppressive thing. It's the naming of your circumstance, the naming of your predicament, and the naming of the obstacle that stands in your way. That's where liberation lives. And so weirdly, I started to mention, you know, when I was underground and in the most dire circumstances of being underground, I never felt freer. I felt as free then as I've ever felt in my life, because we were fighting what we considered to be a righteous battle against empire and white supremacy.
That's fascinating. I guess in some ways, too, it's like the martial art where you just take their energy to empower yourself. Just use that to launch yourself a counterattack in a way.
I think that's absolutely right.
All right. Number five on the Ixnay Not So Dirty Word list is labor. Labor.
Okay.
I almost feel like we've set up like one of those spelling bees. I've never done this before with anyone, but...
You know what, man? I think it's actually a brilliant way to into a conversation, because it pushes, it's not, you know, people, when they interview in a way that's Q&A, everybody gets on automatic pilot. I think there's something interesting about saying, let's mess around with complicated, as I say, dense and layered ideas. You know, to me, this is a fairly straightforward. I mean, labor is what we do to produce wealth. It's what we do to produce, to survive. And everyone is involved in it, but the labor is, labor power is what most human beings, the overwhelming majority of human beings, have nothing but their labor to sell in order to survive. And so that's why I think we have to look at labor and the working class and working people as the engine of what's going to liberate us all.
Yeah. No, I think that the unions are just been so completely overlooked and overridden by, you know, this current kind of neoliberalism or whatever you want to call, this type of capitalism that we live in. One of my go-to economic quips is that if you're concerned that the U.S. is in a global struggle for capital and labor, you might be a Marxist.
Good point. But I would also say, I think it's worth noting, as you and you put it this way, you know, that not only have labor unions been not so much overlooked as crushed.
Right.
I mean, I think the whole movement of neoliberalism and the whole movement from the 19, well, always, there's always a struggle between capital and labor. And so the capitalist class, their ideal situation is profit with no workers. The workers' ideal situation is survival without selling your labor, right? So the conflict is basic. But I think it's important to note that that labor unions have been crushed. And starting in viciously in 1980, the kind of white supremacist regimes that we've had, the kind of anti-labor force, has created conditions where we live in effect a plutocracy. We don't live in a place where the sovereign is the masses of people who get to decide on issues. Where do we get to vote on war? Where do we get to vote on predatory capitalism? Where do we get to vote on issues that really matter to us, including smaller issues, particular issues like gun control or what the education system should be? We don't get to vote on those things. Where do I get to vote that I don't want to bail out United Airlines, or if I do bail them out, I want the profits when the profits are there? I mean, I don't get to vote on those things. So this is, labor has been crushed by the rise of a plutocracy. I think it's the last thing I would note on the question of labor is that we are witnessing something that's really extraordinary, which is a movement, the biggest movement I've ever witnessed, the latest iteration of the Black Freedom Movement, is also a labor movement. It's also a reparations movement. And I think it should be seen in that way. So when you hear kind of white European or white American, you know, Marxist economists talking about labor and missing the fact that there's the biggest uprising of workers that any of us has ever seen, happening right in front of your eyes, that means you're not understanding racial capitalism and the way that it works in our history and in our present context.
Fabulous. All right, let's see. Number six on Ixnay's Not So Dirty Word is probably the most demonized of all of them, liberalism.
Liberalism. Well, I'll add to the demonization maybe. You know, I think that if you're considering liberalism as kind of a political philosophy that includes basic rights like voting, basic rights like the right to speak or the right to freedom of religion, I think liberalism is a long and worthy tradition in that sense. My difficulty with it is that I grew up, came of age when, you know, Kennedy was president and Lyndon Johnson was a liberal. And, you know, and for me, the problem I've always had with liberals and liberal solutions is that they tack away from what I would consider more profound structural reforms. In other words, you know, we get into this situation in our country where the frame of the debate is between predatory capitalist healthcare or Obamacare. And I want to say, but wait, what about this? And to Bernie Sanders' great, great credit, he has put healthcare as a human right on the political agenda. Yes. And I find that an astonishing thing to have witnessed. So now we get to think about not just a liberal solution, Obamacare, but we get to think about, you know, healthcare as a human right. I want to put education as a human right on the agenda. I don't think education be thought of as a product to be sold at the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And then the liberals say, well, let's do it this way. And the reactionaries say, no, let's do it that way. No, I want to say, let's break that frame open. Let's break open that way of thinking of it and say, education is a human right. Housing is a human right. The right to eat food is a human right. So, I mean, once we begin to do it that way, then we're talking about changing the frame from liberal conservative to, you know, a more radical, profound, liberatory kind of vocabulary. So I think liberalism has a worthy historic tradition, but I find it a very corrupting influence in when we start to talk about, for example, the upcoming elections. I mean, is the Democratic Party establishment being accused of being, you know, left-wing, anti-fascist, you know, is their solution really the same as 2016? Pro-policing, pro-war, pro-corporate? I mean, that is just nuts. And yet, I think the social movement from below, fire from below, is not only changing that, but isn't going to allow it to solidify itself in 2020.
Yeah, fun. You know, interestingly enough, I think like Franklin Roosevelt had that second Bill of Rights that included like education, housing, healthcare, those kind of things.
And I'm not so sure that he called it radical at the time, although I seem to remember that he noted something to that point. But that those ideas seem so normal to everyone, but they've been tied somehow to radicalism. It's really kind of mind-bending. And that's why I think that these words, they're not dirty words. They're just ideas that are kind of been tweaked down or just memed. You know, they've all just become that one meme of the guy walking down the street with his girlfriend, but looking over his shoulder at the other girl. And then the girlfriend is like, what are you doing? It's just been so dumbed down by people that everything has a nuance, you know, and that, yeah, I mean, one of my whole points has always been that anyone who really wants to be president probably shouldn't be president, that we should be suspicious of these people, but we are where we are.
I want to get into that, but I want to go back to your point about FDR, because I would say two things about liberalism that, you know, when we look at any profound forward motion in the history of this country, we're looking at fire from below. It's not some guy who gets a change of heart or a brilliant idea.
Right.
I mean, after all, Lyndon Johnson was a cracker from Texas, and he was moved because there was a civil rights movement that was unstoppable. Franklin Roosevelt was a patrician from the Hudson Valley. He was profoundly changed and the irresistible power of the labor movement. Lincoln, if you read Lincoln's first inaugural address, it's a genuflection in front of the slave owners. It was only later, because of the self-liberating enslaved people, because of the abolitionist movement, that the second inaugural address is the one we read in high school.
No.
And I'm saying that to say two things, really. One is, If we're interested in change, we have to walk on two legs. One leg is the mass movements. That's the indispensable leg. You know, without that, there's nothing. The second leg is real politics. And we might be surprised if the movement develops in a certain way right now, Joe Biden might become a hero in terms of the changes he's able to make. Right. I don't know, but I think that that's what happens. It's not the top, you know, doing the bottom. It's really fire from below that makes these things possible. Second thing I would say about FDR and the New Deal is we have to also remember that the original sin of America, you know, the chattel slavery, generational slavery based on African heritage, that sin continues to this day. It not only, you know, reproduced itself decade after decade after decade, but it's happening right now. And in FDR's time, you look at the New Deal and the deal that was struck with the Southern Democrats in order to pass the New Deal legislation, and it's a disaster, it's a catastrophe. And it continues then, the oppression of Black people, you know, the super exploitation of Black people. So I think it's important that we look at our history clear-eyed, and we can admire a lot of things about what happened when FDR or Lyndon Johnson, who passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. But we don't want to get carried away and pretend that that's all there was. There was fire from below. There was the Vietnam War, which was horrible. And there was compromises all over the place. I think our job today is to learn that history and to organize the fire from below as best we can, and also engage in real politics, because that's the second leg in moving forward.
Cool. Well, I think that leads perfectly into the seventh of my not so dirty words, which is social justice.
Well, as I said at the beginning, like any other layered and complex term, it can be something that is, we could spend, you know, hours trying to figure out how to define it. And I wouldn't go to the dictionary.
Yeah, you could write a book. I mean, how many people have written books about it? I mean,
many, sure. Many people. And I would go to history to try to understand it. But I would say this, that social justice means that different people in different epochs, different places, different geographies, different time periods, using a range of tactics that run from, you know, voting to armed struggle to, you know, everything in between. Different tactics, different strategies, different eras, different epochs, but they cohere around a desire for more participation, more recognition, more agency, more collective good. And so we see them bursting out all over, movements for social justice bursting out all over, in the quest for equity, fairness, recognition, which I think is hugely important. I mean, when you think, for example, about the gay liberation struggle, recognition is a huge part of being free. And so I think that we can kind of, there's that simple definition, and then we have to get into the nuts and bolts and get busy building movements that can achieve those kind of just goals.
Yeah, fabulous. Well, so let's get back to sort of the election and maybe a more personal kind of idea about things. It's like the main gist of Ixnay to this point was to convince people of the importance of being involved in the electoral process, because Trump, we thought, and we still feel, is supremely unfit. And to that point, I'm curious how the Trump presidency has affected you and yours these last 4 years, and what you hope for going forward.
Well, I said, as many people did in the beginning, that Trump was an authoritarian autocrat with fascist tendencies. And I remember when I wrote about it 4 years ago, I kept saying, I know the word is misused and the word is extravagant, but the reality is that so many things that he stood for were indeed tendencies toward fascism. 3.5 years later, our worst fears have been realized. He has built the container for a real fascist upsurge. And while I think it's also important to note, going back 4 years, the day after the election, Bernadine and I looked at each other and said, if you were surprised at the outcome of this election, it's understandable. It was surprising. It was shocking. some ways. If you're surprised 2 days later, you don't know what country you live in. You don't understand the nature of this country. And I am all with you around United Front to defeat Trump and to get away from the kind of fascism that we're seeing develop. But if you think then that the fascist movement is going to go away or that the white supremacist base is going to magically disappear, again, you don't know the country you live in. So I think it's hugely important to defeat Trump. And I think anyone who thinks that it's a Tweedledum, Tweedledumber situation has lost their mind. I mean, this is actually has serious consequences for real people in their real lives. And so to be cavalier about it is foolish. On the other hand, I think, if you think voting him out is the end of your responsibility, no, that's just the beginning. I've always thought for my whole adult life that to vote is a principle. I must vote. You must vote. Voting is something people die and fight for, and we must vote. On the other hand, the act of voting is a tactic, not a principle and not a strategy. You do it because it takes 2 minutes. And the idea that somehow you're making a big statement by saying, I won't vote for that bastard. What are you talking about even? I don't even begin to kind of wrap my mind around it. Are you saying, well, the Democrats are predictably pro-corporate, pro-policing, pro-war? Yes, I know that. I agree with you. And you think what? That Jill Stein is somehow God's gift to the world and somehow issuing that vote will make a huge difference? Non-voting doesn't register. Nobody knows when you don't vote, did you not vote because of voter suppression? Did you not vote because you were sick that day? Did you not vote because you couldn't get to the polls? Or were you making some grand statement? Your grand statement didn't register. So not voting is, in my mind, a kind of foolishness. But pretending that voting is the end of your responsibility as a citizen is nuts, because that's just 1 2-minute thing. So I think people who are doing their organizing online and being pissed off at the people who don't vote, I mean, if all they do is that, they're pretty much as irrelevant as the people who don't vote. So I think what we need, we not only need to kind of be part of and to participate in the mass movement that's happening, we need to find ways, and I'm sure the young people who are defining the terms of this are finding ways to create containers in which our protests can be more meaningful, in which our protests can have impact, not only in the voting booth, but impact in the corporate world, impact in questions like education and healthcare and decarceration and so on. But I think that to not vote is foolish. I think to think that voting is the be all and end all of your responsibility as a political person is equally foolish. So I don't want to do either. I want to vote, take me 5 minutes, and then I want to get out and get busy building the kind of movement that will really change things.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point in assuming that like organizing and activism is kind of a paramount necessity, not just this year, but going forward.
Absolutely.
And I guess the question is, how do you convince people that the struggle itself is worth it? Especially like we're in this age where not just Trump saying winning, but people only want to do things that they think they can win, right? So they're not really just in it to be part of the struggle sometimes. It's like, I don't know if you really have an answer or if there is an answer, because what I hear you saying is that the young people are going to come up with a way to do this. But if we could help to encourage people to just say, listen, you got to do it. You may not be the worst to cross the tape as the victor. You may not really be winning, but you've got to stick with the fight.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that, but I would say this, that, I think it's very important that people participate. Exercise your agency. And the reason I say that is I've taught for, well, how many years have I been a teacher? About 50 years. I say to my students, I teach right now at DePaul University at the University of Chicago, and I always say to my students, you would have been there on the bridge with Martin Luther King, the Selma Bridge. You'd have been there, right? Oh, yes, absolutely. And you'd have saved Anne Frank, for sure. And you'd have ridden with Harriet Tubman and John Brown, absolutely. Guess what? You have a chance right now. And I've said that for 50 years. It happens that right now you really do have a chance. But I've always felt that. You have a chance to be engaged if you choose to be engaged. There is a very true point in what you're saying, and that is that people know that they're messed over. People know that they're alienated. People know they're exploited and or oppressed. But they have to know also that they could win. And winning, I mean, the ability to get something done is what powers you to take the risk. So you think Black people in the South from the end of the Civil War to the 1950s didn't know they were messed over? They knew. But what was that magic that said, if I go down to the courthouse and register and risk my life, my children, my grandchildren, even I will have a better life? No one knows what that magic was, but it had something to do with the coming together of the murder of Emmett Till. It had something to do with this young preacher, you know, being in Birmingham. It had something to do with this activist who had tried to get arrested many times, sitting in the bus and suddenly getting arrested, and the community was organized. It had many things to do, but it's worth noting that organizing had been going on in Birmingham for year after year after year. Lots of heroic people, unsung many of them, but had been doing that for years. What we're seeing right now is another example, because why is it that something that you and I could not have imagined even 2 years ago is suddenly being discussed? Prison abolition? You mean in the page of the New York Times, they're talking about defund the police? Naomi Osaka's boyfriend sitting in the stands at the US Open wearing a t-shirt that says defund the police? It's on international television. It's unthinkable. Reparations, a front page story in the New York Times magazine section. I've been talking about reparations since I was 20 years old. This is staggering to me. Why did it happen? Because this is not just spontaneous. The Black Lives Matter kids, who I know in Chicago, have been on the ground, door to door, neighborhood to neighborhood, building a movement, defining the narrative that would burst out when the struggle took the form that it took.
Got it.
And the narrative was there. So that's one point that I think is hugely important. The second point, to your point, is that if you're not part of the movement, you have no right to speak. I don't mean it quite that harshly, but what I mean is when the kids, when the young people and others, including us, went to occupy Wall Street, when we occupied city after city, and then we listened to Bill Clinton offering advice, you shouldn't dress that way, you should dress this way. Get in line, man, for the communal microphone. Don't give me your bullshit. I don't care what you think. You're not part of it. You're not in it with us. If you're in it with us, then we'll talk. But that's a very important lesson for right here, right now. If you want to be part of the conversation about the direction and the need to move in certain ways, you're looking at a movement in the last 6 months in which 26 million people went to the streets, most of them for the first time. That's a staggering thing to wrap your mind around. You want to be part of that? Be part of the 26 million and have your voice heard. But don't sit to the sidelines or sit up in your penthouse with Bill Clinton and tell us what to do. You have no, we have no interest in what you think. Get into the struggle, then you have a voice.
Yeah, I sometimes think about like the science fiction stories, like the butterfly effect, where they go back in time and accidentally change something, the unforeseeable, right? That when you are involved in a situation, you're not out there thinking that something you do today is actively going to steamroll into this giant, magnificent movement. But you have to stand up for what you think is right. And that sometimes can be enough, right? That just talking to your neighbors, going, you know, the smallest little things could light the fuse.
Absolutely. Your point is very, very important. And it's important to say that if you want to live a moral life, an ethical life, I suddenly, what came to mind was Mark Twain wrote a wonderful, wonderful essay called Free Speech is for the Grave. And what he said was most of us want to be liked. Most of us want to get along. Most of us live in a neighborhood. Most of us go shopping. And he said, so mostly we don't say the truth. We don't tell the truth. We kind of hedge because we want to get along. And when you're getting along in a society like ours, you're getting along with war and racism, for starters, and sexism and patriarchy and a lot else. So what Twain says is, after he kind of makes that point, he says, my killer example is slavery. I don't know anyone who supports slavery. I don't know anyone who speaks up against it. And that he's writing from, you know, Missouri. And that's the jam that we find ourselves in. So we should provoke one another to speak up, to speak out, to join the movement, to be a part of it. And yes, being just saying, I want to define myself, you know, existentially, I want to be a person who stands against nuclear war. I want to be a person who stands against kids in cages. I mean, that's a beginning. That's something. We're way beyond that in the streets right now. But the thing that came to my mind when you said it that way is that the state of Illinois many years ago decided to reinstate the death penalty and kill John Wayne Gacy. And, you know, the death penalty had... they'd won the right in the Supreme Court to kill people, and they had this death row, and so suddenly executions could happen again in Illinois. We had three little kids. We drew straws. I won. So I drove the night that they were executing John Wayne Gacy. We were, I'll tell you, the context is we were horrified by all the news reports, by all the happiness that people were expressing that Gacy was going to be killed. And we thought, God, I don't trust the state of Illinois to collect taxes or fix the streets. I'm going to trust them to kill people? No. So I won. I went down there. I got there at about 11 o'clock. He was going to be murdered at midnight. There were 1,500 kids there having a beer and rock and roll party to celebrate the death of the monster. I had my little thou shalt not kill sign. I put it under my coat. I made my way to the front of the line of the prison. And there I found 9 elderly nuns and 2 lawyers and me singing freedom songs, objecting. And the police were keeping the pro-death penalty people away from us.
Jesus.
And if I've ever felt marginal, I felt marginal that night. Mm-hmm. One of the lawyers standing next to me was a colleague of my partner's at Northwestern University. Within a year, he had won the first of the wrongful conviction cases in Illinois. Within 5 years, he and the movement that grew up, and it was a big movement, lawyers, journalists, but also mothers of guys on death row, the death row 10, community organizers. Illinois became the first, you know, state to really become abolitionists around the death penalty.
Wow.
Our corrupt right-wing governor, George Ryan, took everyone off death row right before he stepped out of office. Unthinkable. So was my participation in that particularly important? No, it was not. But it mattered to me and it mattered to us to define ourselves as against the state of Illinois killing people. And who knew? We also got swept up in a movement that was much bigger than us, which we wouldn't have known about likely, but we did know about. And so I think that's important that you make a moral stand on issues of life and death, war and peace, you know, exploitation and liberation. Make those choices. You don't have to kind of kill yourself every day, but you have to do something. You have to say something.
Yeah, that's an incredible example. Incredible. Why don't you talk a little bit about your podcast and
why you started that? Lay it on me.
That's so funny. I think the fact that I started a podcast is an indication that podcasts have become passé. I mean, I think that if I can, if I know enough to start a podcast, then it must already have passed us by. It's like when
this
I learned
a
new
pot meat joke.
Yeah, exactly. It's like when I know a certain slang term, that's no longer a hip slang term. That's something that every fucking 15-year-old knows, and I don't. Yeah. I just learned it. But the reason was simple. I'm 75 years old. I've been retired for 10 years. And I have some young friends who are very much in the middle of this Black Lives Matter movement in Chicago who have done different kinds of podcasts. And I was talking to a couple of them one day, 6 months ago, and they said, you ought to start a podcast. And I said, how does one do it? I barely know how to get my computer started, you know, and they said, look, let's sit down. I sat down with two of them for maybe 6 hours over the course of a few weeks. And they asked me the best questions. They asked me questions like what I'm reading. They asked me questions like where I'm most comfortable. They asked me, you probably know all this, but this was all news to me. They asked me who I like to be in conversation with. They asked me all these questions. And at the end of about 6 or 8 hours together over stretched over a few weeks, We came up with this idea that where I'm really comfortable is in the seminar room. And where I'm really happy is teaching seminars. You know, that's what I do. And so we ended up with this idea of starting a podcast called Under the Tree, a seminar on freedom. And the Under the Tree image is from the Freedom Schools in Mississippi. And the idea is that school, seminar, does not have to meet in a classroom, doesn't have to meet in a school or a university. Seminar can meet in a community center, a neighborhood, or just under a tree in a field. And in many ways, those are the seminars that are most exciting because they assume that when we sit in a circle, it's not that there's a great mind telling other people what to think. Rather, we unlock the wisdom in the circle, and that becomes the energy that moves us all forward. And the image is taken from the Mississippi Freedom Schools of 1964. Oh. And they did sometimes meet under the tree. And that's where the inspiration comes from. And I've been able to have a lot of wonderful, wonderful people. I've only done 9 so far. After we do 10, we're going to take a pause and reflect on what we've done and what we've learned. And frankly, each time it gets better because the learning curve is steep. But I've had a bunch of guests on. Two of them, I don't know how I got. One is my son, Chesa Boudin, who's the district attorney of San Francisco. And getting him was pretty easy. And the another one I got, which I think was one of the great interviews, is with Bernadine Dorn, my partner of 50 years. I don't know how I got her. But also people like Alec Karakatsanis, who wrote a book called Usual Cruelty about the criminal injustice system. And I interviewed Catherine Franke, who wrote a book about reparations called Repair. She's a scholar at Columbia University. And many other people, David Stovall, Lisa Lee, the director of the National Public Housing Museum. So I've had a great time, some great conversations. And Bernadine wants me to tell you that one of the great features in the podcast is a 12-year-old named Light I. Lee, who gives us reports from the front row. And she is the most, she's a dynamic, funny, observant 12-year-old who tells stories about school. And so that's the fun of it. And I've loved doing it. And it keeps me off the street. I'm busy with my podcast, except when you call, then I have to get onto the street and
well, this is what they
hang out with you.
Well, this is what they all do, is like just podcasters talking to podcasters a little bit sometimes.
I love it.
Well, we'll get you out of here on this one. I've been saying to people who listen to the podcast a lot that you should look at November 3rd as if you were planning a party. Because people like to plan parties. People like to get involved in that. So love I was it. Like, make a list. Tell all your friends. Tell them where to be. Tell them what to do. Tell them what to bring. And then maybe have a party, but they had to have voted to come to the party. So I guess my question for you is, well, I'll say too also that we are going to have a party. We're going to live stream a party with the music and a DJ from New York. And I'm just curious what your plan, if you have plans on November 3rd, will you vote in person? Are you going to vote early? Are you going to vote by mail?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I plan to attend your party. So that's the first thing I'm going to do on November 3rd. Okay. Second thing is that I'm planning to vote by mail. And there's an argument going on in our house because my partner wants to vote in person, which I'm all for, but I don't want to vote in person. I want to vote by mail. I think she feels more concrete if she can walk down there and hand the thing in. The tricky part, of course, as people are pointing out, is that voter suppression has been the name of the game for a long, 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 long time, our whole history, really. This election is got danger written all over it. And I think we could see things that were unthinkable for the last 100 years. I think we could see violence at the polls. I think we could see intimidation at the polls like we haven't seen since the Deep South 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I think we could also see a president who refuses to leave. I think we could see martial law. I think there's so many things we could see, not predicting any of it. But I think it's hugely important that people be mobilized in their own minds to defend their right to vote. You have a right to vote. And as I say, the right to vote for me is a principle. But then we have to, before the vote and after the vote, insist that we are active citizens and that we are active residents and that we have a responsibility to act whatever happens November 3rd. We have a responsibility to go back to conversations, back to insisting on fundamental change around healthcare as a human right, around an end to the Pentagon budget, around the end of the militarization of police, and so on and so on. So I think we have a lot of work to do. But yes, I'll vote by mail. My partner will likely go down and vote in person. And then we'll be ready to go out the next day and get busy working to expand and extend the realm of justice, peace, transparency, participation, love, and joy.
Well, thank you very much for your time. That was fabulous. That's a great way to wrap things up and put a bow on it.
I appreciate it, Trace. Thanks so much for what you're doing.
For a limited time, we're inviting Americans of strong moral fiber to participate in our Slap 'em Up sticker campaign. For $5, we'll send you a pack of Ixnay's classic anti-Trump stickers, guaranteed to help you win friends and influence people. You see, around the country, people are stressed out by the current political climate, and we found that peeling the back from these stickers is a kind of self-care. And when followed by boldly or even clandestinely applying them in fun places, a lift of spirit is guaranteed. And that's what I think we all need, a recharge of spirit. America was founded by rabble-rousers protesting reactionary pressure. Think of applying these stickers as a tribute to that revolutionary fervor. So go to ixnaypack.org to order your stickers and slap them up, America. It's fun, it's provocative, it's pig Latin. All right, by this point, you know the drill. Go to ixnaypack.org and figure out a way to participate in unelecting Donald Trump. I'll even make you a deal. If you help us, you can use me as a reference on your resume. Talk about bargains. So thanks again for listening. And if you're out on your bike tonight, don't forget, the nature of your oppression is the aesthetic of our anger. Ixnay.